welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, a show by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week's Groundwire is produced at CHSR-FM at the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton, New Brunswick. I'm your host, Jordan McDonald. In this edition, we'll take a look at the connection between mental disorders and creativity. We'll find out about the access to abortion clinics in rural Canada, and Candace Moores interviews Max Haven on the value of art schools. But first, a look at national news.
Over 70 activist organizations have pledged to no longer cooperate with Canada's intelligence agency, known as CSIS. The pledge was spearheaded by Montreal-based People's Commission Network. The network monitors Canadian anti-terrorism laws. Marie-Ève Lemay is a spokesperson for the network. She told The Dominion, quote, "Visits by CSIS are meant to create psychological profiles, to instill distrust, and to create tensions within groups and communities." Lemay's views were echoed by other participants who say that they have been harassed by CSIS officials. Dolores Chu, head of Montreal's South Asian Community Center, says CSIS visits intimidate activists from engaging in social protests and that many immigrants feel they are obligated to talk with CSIS officials. The idea for the pledge was sparked in early 2010. That year, says CSIS, saw CSIS officials carry out a number of unannounced visits to activists. The organizations say such visits were a deliberate tactic to undermine protests of the Olympic Games and G20 meetings. In an unsuspected turn of events, the Vancouver Police Complaints Commissioner has challenged a BC Supreme Court decision that quashed a public hearing into a 2010 police beating. The public hearing was going to investigate the beating of Yao Wei Wu. In January 2010, Wu was attacked by two Vancouver police officers. The officers were responding to a case of domestic violence. They went to the right house, but wrong suite. Wu says the officers attacked him when he answered the door. Photos taken after the incident show Wu with a massive, swollen black eye and a bruised cheek. The incident was serious enough to warrant an external police investigation into the incident. It was conducted by Delta Police. Delta is a municipality just south of Vancouver. It's part of Metro Vancouver. Delta Police cleared the officers involved of any wrongdoing, and that prompted the Vancouver Police Commissioner, Alan Lowe, to step in. In December 2010, Lowe ordered a police investigation into the incident. Yet last month, a Supreme Court judge ruled that Lowe overstepped his bounds and stopped the inquiry. The ruling, say some, could set a precedent and detract from the Police Complaints Commissioner's ability to conduct investigations. The case has garnered considerable media coverage. Deputy Police Complaints Commissioner Rowley Woods says the attention helped motivate the commissioner's latest action. Speaking to Vancouver's News 1130, he said, quote, "There's a significant amount of interest in it. I guess it made it easier for him to decide that he'll appeal it." Reporting for Groundwire, I'm Joel Bard.
And now, how about some music? That was Shelter for My Strength by Live How You Live on their album Blue Collar Love. And now we get into our feature stories. Mental health and creativity have long since been connected in people's minds. Everyone from Van Gogh to Bach have been cited as having issues in this field. Bobby Ogliffe spoke to a Fredericton artist to find out his opinions.
Could being an artist mean you're both crazy and creative? More mental health research is trying to include personality traits as a way to explore aspects of mental health. In a 2005 Stanford study, researchers from the School of Medicine were able to show that those high in the character trait of creativity were more likely to experience bipolar depression. This falls in line with a now growing body of research suggesting that creativity is highly linked to various mood disorders. So what does this mean for someone who relies on their creativity for their professional work? What does this mean for an artist? One local artist out of Fredericton has been struggling with his mental health for most of his adult life. He is an artist, but he's an artist also, too, who's had to suffer with schizoaffective disorder for most of his life. I would say all of your adult life.
Really, from about age 25 onward, sensory perception just gets heightened with these conditions. I have an intense visual recall of much of my life, and it's visually oriented, the state of my memory and mind. Mm-hmm. And you can say that lends to the visual arts. On one hand, yes, painting is not really... It's a different kind of thing. It's a cognitive exercise. It's more of a hand to mind, not direct mind to, mm-hmm. to kind of static interface as we're getting now in technology.
While some aspects of mental health may provide more useful utility, such as the ability to see things in a different way, others may have more positive and negative aspects to them by blurring the ability to discern what is true reality.
What I came across was an increased lucidity in dreams that offered psychic messages, offered accurate kind of forecasts for what would just be unveiling.
Rather than seeing it as something personally developed, the artist is able to see that aspects of this are an affliction or illness put upon him.
I'm dreaming as soon as I rest and entering that level of consciousness and taking in that kind of information mm-hmm. while at rest. Now, that was an affliction. That wasn't so much a choice or out of exploration.
Even as someone with a mental health disorder may feel symptoms coming on and feel themselves becoming triggered in some way, they may acknowledge, too, that they're not fully in control of what's about to occur.
You know, mm-hmm. once you start to experience those states, you have to either fully go with it or, well, that's the only choice you have.
It's easy to see how professional problems could arise when one's not always in control of what behaviors of theirs are about to occur. Many also suffer much worse symptoms with certain triggers or demands present. As such, this creates an unhealthy inverse relationship between trying to preserve one's mental health and trying to professionally and financially sustain oneself.
I'm really not the type to try to create an economy out of some of these abilities. And there are people who do that, and I'm completely fine with it. People who work mm-hmm. with who as psychic mediums or as mediums in general. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I have a communication ongoing with such divisions of reality that I just don't choose to franchise upon. I think it would complicate my life a little too greatly if I were to.
Well, some aspects of his life, the artist has also tried to make workable. He does admit that it can be difficult when hallucinations can be so immersive and engaging.
I'm cognitive very much mm-hmm. as a human operating around here as a little gremlin doing international art and things like that and having fun and, you know, having rewarding relationships, different kinds of relationships, I got to say, because there's a point where once you begin to get communications from voices that aren't your own from afar that are auditory hallucinations mm-hmm. or visual hallucinations, if you will. When you're experiencing those hallucinations, though, there's nothing really too hallucinatory or illusory about it. It's very organized information.
Well, mood disorders are certainly not the same as having schizoaffective disorder. Using personality traits as predictors for mental health is still a very burgeoning field, and specifically dealing with creativity and all of the links it has to various mental health disorders. Because the mental health field was not as developed at the time that these artists or great persons lived, many such persons we would now consider to have various mental illnesses. For example, many scientists, including Albert Einstein, show the eccentricities of schizotypal personality disorder. Many playwrights and novelists have suffered from repression, such as Ernest Hemingway. Others, while not being able to categorically define them as having a mental disorder, in a trait-like and more dimensional scale, are more prone to some of their symptoms. This is equally backed up by the fact that many mental health disorders have very large elements of inheritability. In the case of 20th century philosopher Bertrand Russell, the fact that four of his close family members were diagnosed with schizophrenia shows the likelihood of him showing some symptoms of the disease, even if it happens to be at a subclinical and non-diagnosable level. So must artists suffer for their work? Reframing the question, we could look at it as, does one need to have a mental disorder to be creatively effective? The answer is certainly no. If you find yourself suffering from mental health symptoms, please speak to your doctor, find a therapist, understand the medications that you may need, and use many other strategies to help try to find a workable solution. So remember, just because you're creative doesn't have to mean you're crazy.
Thank you very much, Bobby.
Prince Edward Island is the only province in Canada that does not provide local access to abortion services. Many women who live on PEI have to travel off the island to get an abortion either in Fredericton, New Brunswick, or in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Groundwire reporter Lindsay Beattie spoke with Broadwin Rod, a spokeswoman with the PEI reproductive rights organization, also known as PRO, P-R-R-O. This organization was formed in 2011 and advocates for the access to abortion on Prince Edward Island.
What are the options for someone wanting an abortion in PEI?
There are two routes, one of which is to get a doctor referral here, and then that goes through a second doctor referral, which sounds more prohibitive than it actually is. It's supposed to be just sort of a rubber stamp kind of thing. And then they go to a Halifax in hospital, and it's performed there. And it is funded by the province of PEI. Travel costs, however, are not funded. And travel costs to Halifax are usually around $200, $250 at least. Then there's the surrounding costs of time off work and so forth. The other route, which a lot of women choose because it's quicker, and this is obviously a time-sensitive procedure, is to go to the private clinic in Fredericton, New Brunswick. But those are not funded by the province. There's actually a court case right now in New Brunswick because of the fact that this private clinic isn't funded, and New Brunswick is, we believe, and others believe too, that New Brunswick is in violation of the law by not funding this private abortion clinic. But some women from PEI go to the Fredericton clinic, and that costs anywhere from, well, when you factor in travel costs, it can cost up to $1,000.
So you kind of got into a little bit. Who does this mostly affect?
Definitely low-income women. Obviously, the province's position is that they do provide access to abortion. To not provide access would be out-and-out illegal. But the fact of the matter is that this is not a situation where there is equal access. Because lower-income women face additional difficulties, obviously, coming up with that money, and we do know there are documented cases of women who simply cannot afford to go over and get this legal medical procedure done. It is a medically necessary procedure, and it's our position that because the government has all sort of the equipment, all the necessary tools here to provide the procedure, you know, we have the doctors, we have the necessary medical equipment, this isn't an issue of funding. It's our position that they need to provide access to it here immediately, especially for lower-income women who are the most victimized by this lack of access.
Can you maybe get into why people aren't talking about this issue and the stigma around abortions in PEI when there clearly are funding and people that can do it there?
Well, it's a tough thing. There is just a culture of silence around abortion on PEI. There was one main effort more than a decade ago to get access to abortion here. It wasn't successful. Part of that was due to just sort of the legal wording around the case, and it became slightly more nuanced than was really necessary. But the reason why it's not talked about is because there is quite an organized and vocal contingent here of Right to Life people and organizations. They, in response to our campaign, they've launched year-long campaign of information or campaign of truth or something like that. That's what they call it, spreading the usual myths about abortion. And they took out a full-page ad in the local newspaper a few weeks ago in order to, you know, propagate these myths. We know of at least one doctor who anonymously spoke to the media and said that while he is, you know, personally pro-choice and would like to see abortions provided here, he would be afraid to provide those services because he would be afraid of reprisal, you know, and going home to picketers on his lawn. And part of that is because it's a vocal contingent, and part of that is also because PEI is such a small place and confidentiality is difficult, very difficult here. And we just haven't had politicians who have been brave enough to stand up to the very vocal Right to Life people here and say, you know, look, this is the law. This isn't an ideological issue anymore. This is the law. We know of, you know, a number of politicians who are personally pro-choice, but publicly, their public stance is much more equivocal than that. And it's really unfortunate, and it's really, I'm extremely disappointed in our politicians.
So in the current state, what is PRO doing in PEI in terms of getting more awareness out?
Part of what we've done is we've urged the government to make information about abortion and abortion services more available because a lot of women did not know, we hope more know now, but they did not know that the province funded abortions at all, even though it was out of province. They thought that their only option would be to go over to Fredericton and pay the $1,000. And that is not the case. The province funds, you know, numerous abortions throughout year. And so that information has become more accessible on the website. We've also gotten Health PEI to send out information packages to every island doctor who might be asked to provide a referral so that they know the policy and what they're asked to do. And so that has been a very positive step, but there's still more, still more that needs to be done. And we also sort of work in alliance with a number of other women's groups here. There is a current research project being headed by Colleen McCrory, who's a professor at UPEI, and they're looking into holding these sort of town hall meetings where their research findings are just shared in the community. And the research findings are simply, you know, these are just interviews with women who have gone through either abortions or other procedures within reproductive health services in PEI and who have struggled or not with the lack of access here. We've also gotten into a few classes. We've been able to talk to a few, well, at least one high school class. We know we're going to be getting into the university and talking to a few classes there. So it's sort of a multi-pronged approach that we're taking to getting the information at least more accessible.
I guess maybe something you can comment on is with the, you know, with generally no access to abortion on PEI, there must be a lot of unsafe operations that that happen.
I don't personally know of any attempts at surgical abortion, but certainly women, lots of PEI women do self-induce in various chemical ways. there are lots of different sort of folk remedies of dubious efficacy, of course, because all the information around it is anecdotal. But the research project that Dr. McCrory is heading will, I think, have some very shocking information related to that and the number of women who do have to resort to self-induction. Yeah, and it's not safe. And the government is, I think, fully responsible for forcing these women to turn to these much less safe procedures when there's a legal medical procedure that takes not more than 10 minutes. It's perfectly safe, and we have the means to provide it here.
Reporting for Groundwire, that was Lindsay Beattie in Montreal.
That was Leanne Arnonson introducing the interview. Max Haven is an adjunct professor at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. He recently released an article on the financial crisis at the school. Candace Moores spoke to him on this and many other topics. This is part of their conversation.
You relate what's going on with NASCAD to the broader financial crisis, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the financial crisis of 2008. How has it affected post-secondary education in Nova Scotia?
Pretty dramatically. I mean, Nova Scotia has been a very poor province, really since Confederation. But in the past 20 or 30 years, things have really gone downhill. So the province definitely feels that its economic fortunes are not going well. And the financial crisis of 2008 sort of compounded that. That has sort of led the province, even with an NDP government, to contract budgets. So the NDP government has lifted the cap on tuition fees and also decreased provincial funding to post-secondary education pretty dramatically. But more generally, I think that the problem that is what the 2008 crisis wasn't just sort of bankers making off with the money. It was sort of the manifestation of a much deeper crisis of values in our society, which is, you know, 30 or 40 years into the neoliberal revolution, where people insisted that society should take a back seat to the market. Our entire society's way of understanding what is valuable is completely skewed, so that things are only seen as valuable if they facilitate the making of profit or if they run with a sort of corporate efficiency. So something like NASCAD and higher education more generally has gone from being seen as sort of a public good where we'd all pool our money and invest it together in order to, you know, educate the youth of our society to become future citizens. It's gone from that to being understood to be an investment in one's own unique and individual future.
What are some of the other ways that the relationship between a fine arts education and the market economy play out?
Well, I think you see it in the way that educational programs are being constricted. So increasingly students are being encouraged to understand their options at post-secondary education in a very instrumental fashion. You know, going to get a liberal arts education is seen as, you know, a useless frill, and going into, for instance, business or engineering or medicine or another hands-on program has been encouraged for a lot of students. But the other thing that's happened is that even within the liberal arts, including the fine arts at NASCAD or things like English, sociology, psychology, all those sorts of programs, is that they've had their own internal sort of financialization where every program is now having to think about how it can offer practical or business-ready skills.
Max, you touched on this a few minutes ago. You mentioned the creative economy, and I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what the term creative economy means.
Well, I think the creative economy is sort of two overlapped things. I think predominantly the idea of the creative economy is an overhyped term that has allowed arts and culture professionals to carve out a space within this new neoliberal scene. So in a world where everything has to answer to the bottom line, and the only value people recognize for things like art or education or culture are its economic spin-offs, increasingly gallerists, arts professionals, arts administrators, art advocates, and art policymakers have been using this idea that under globalization, manufacturing jobs are leaving and our economies are somehow becoming more creative, and we should be putting more money into creative ventures. And there's this rhetoric about creative cities that, you know, if you put together a new art center in like old abandoned factories, then that's going to stimulate tourism and economic growth. So this idea of the creative economy is sort of the commodification of creativity.
Why else are you skeptical of the rhetoric of the so-called creative economy?
Well, for one, I think it offers governments a very cheap solution to social problems. I mean, what happens with the rhetoric of the creative economy is it allows governments who are now cutting back in many other sectors to make these sort of small targeted investments in, say, a new arts complex or a community art venture. Governments make these sort of small investments in these things and say, oh, look, you know, we're doing something for the arts, we're doing something for the neighborhood, when in fact what the arts in the neighborhood need are massive injections of cash in order to create a sort of vibrant cultural field that is overseen by the community and by the arts community more generally.
What is the relationship between the discourse of the creative economy and a fine arts education?
Well, I think NASCAD, of course, has seen the declining fortunes of Nova Scotia for a long time, and they've recognized that governments will increasingly have less of an appetite to support an art school. So it was felt, I think, a number of years ago that NASCAD would need to look for other justifications other than just sort of academic excellence for its reason to be. So a number of recent presidents have sort of embraced this rhetoric of the creative economy and suggested that NASCAD can be a sort of anchor or a hub for creative activity in the city. It sort of reduces what an art school is for to simply how it can serve, you know, this sort of abstract idea that our economy should somehow get more creative. And again, what we lose when we become sort of infatuated with that language is the fact that arts exist in order to challenge our ideas about what society is about and to make us rethink what community could mean and rethink what's valuable fundamentally. You know, we need the arts not just because they create economic value, but to force us to think that economic value might not be the most valuable thing.
If you'd like to learn more on this topic, Haven's article, What is the Value of an Art School, is on Art Threat. Now, a short music break.
We'll be right back.
That was Global Empire's Fall by Slide on their album Feed the Machine. Now it's time for our community radio report. McGill University recently refused to abide by the results of a referendum. It was on the continuance of CKUT and QPIRG, and whether the media fee will be opt-outable. Leon Arnenson has the story.
This past November, like every 5 years, CKUT, along with another student group, QPIRG McGill, the Quebec Public Interest Research Group, held a referendum. The referendum called for McGill students to vote on whether to continue supporting both the existence of these two groups, as well as whether to discontinue the university's online opting out system. On November 17, 2011, both groups, QPIRG and CKUT, won an overwhelming yes vote in favor of renewal of their student fees, as well as a move from online to in-person opt-outs. However, on January 19th, the McGill administration announced a refusal to observe the student vote, saying that the referendum question lacked clarity. Caitlin Manicombe, funding coordinator at CKUT Radio.
CKUT ran a referendum question that was almost identical to a referendum question that QPIRG ran as well. The McGill administration did not observe the results of this referendum. It was supported overwhelmingly by McGill students. I think we received a 72% yes vote, if I remember correctly, which is pretty high. The McGill administration had qualms about the question being unclear and about CKUT changing the online opt-out system. So there's definitely been, over the past few years, a lot of support for removing this online opt-out system. The McGill administration hasn't listened. We obviously have discussed it with them on numerous occasions as well. It's really important that independent student organizations like CKUT are able to administer their own refunds and are able to have some say over how their funds are being given back to students.
On February 7, 2012, students and faculty members gathered on the McGill University campus to protest the administration's refusal to observe the vote. The people organizing the event called this action not a protest, but a surprise resignation party for the Deputy Provost of Student Life and Learning, Morton Mendelson, one of the administrators they consider chiefly responsible for McGill's decision to invalidate the results of the referendum. In conjunction with the resignation party, two sets of groups occupied the administration building at McGill. One group occupied the deputy's office on the sixth floor. A larger group occupied the lobby.
So far, the only students who have stood up in anger and in opposition to the McGill administration's decision to ignore the student vote are the students who are currently occupying the James administration building. The occupation was not organized by any members of CKUT or QPIRG. And we had, in fact, already reached an agreement with the McGill administration that they would acknowledge the existence portion of our fall referendum question prior to the occupation having begun.
CKUT began negotiating with the McGill administration over the referendum question in January of this year and has recently announced that they plan to redo the process again starting March 8th.
I hope that McGill students know that CKUT supports the right of any student to protest peacefully, assemble. They have a right to assembly, and I think that we want to express our support to the occupiers in that way, or the partiers, as they like to call themselves. But we also hope for the support of the majority of McGill students, because we are invaluable service and provide a sense of community for a lot of different types of McGill students.
On Sunday, February 12th, the partiers occupying the sixth floor of the James Administration Building were given an eviction notice. After 6 days of their occupation, they left peacefully in the presence of members of the Montreal Police Department. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Leanne Arneson at CKUT in Montreal.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. From CHSR in Fredericton, I'm Jordan McDonald. Thanks for tuning in. Music this week was by Live How You Live and Slide. Headlines this week were written by Joel Bard. I'd also like to thank Bobby Ogliff and Candace Moores from CHSR and Leanne Arneson from CKUT. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.